everybody, to another episode of our podcast, 1,000 Years of Beer. Here, recorded in the Museum of the World's Oldest Brewery, Weinstephan. And I'm Matthias, the International Brand Ambassador and Brewer of the brewery. And to my side, our Online Marketing Manager, Anton. Hey, how are you doing?
Hey, welcome everybody. Thank you for listening in. And as you know, the topic sensory is very important to us. So important that this is the third episode about it. We had one in season one, season two, and this is season three. And as you can imagine, for all you listeners out there, we had one on the basics of sensory. We had one on top fermented beers. And of course, as you can imagine, this is about bottom fermented beers. And we have the expert from the Technical University of Munich here with us. And Matthias, as it is in a good tradition, you're the one to introduce our guest.
Yes. Hello and welcome. Florian Lehnhardt, the head of the Sensorial Analysis Laboratory of the Institute for Brewing and Beverage Technology of Technical University Munich School of Life Sciences, Weinstephan. Hello and welcome. The third time, Florian.
Well, thanks again.
And just a short introduction. You are a food chemistrist and you are actually working on your PhD in the field of aging of bottom fermented lager beers.
Exactly.
And actually, that's kind of your core topic we're talking about today. We're talking about sensorial aspects and compounds and aromas and flavors of bottom fermented beers today. And so this is now your home game, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
And thanks for being back on the show. I really appreciate it. And well, then let's
jump
dig into it.
All right. So as you know, we are well known for our wheat beers, for our top fermented beers. But we do have a wide range, and an even wider range, actually, of bottom fermented beers. So just to have a basis on what we built this podcast here, can you define for us what's a bottom fermented beer in a scientific way, maybe?
I guess in Germany, of course, you're bound to the purity law, bottom fermented beers are only brewed with barley malts, 100%. And so that's one core aspect there. Of course, you have the hops as well. And another interesting part is the bottom fermenting yeast in combination with the low temperatures. I think that's the key differences to the top fermenting beers.
So in our episode on the aroma and flavor of wheat beers, we found that, or you explained that there are a few aspects in wheat beers that are defining it and very significantly, or very, very strict, actually, that in the most cases, the Bavarian-style wheat beers are hazy. That means they have a special mouthfeel due to proteins and yeast that's still in it. They have a higher carbonation compared to lagers, and they are very intense in some aroma compounds, like the banana or the cloves aroma. So those aspects I just said, they're basically or nearly defining all different kind of wheat beers, mm-hmm. especially the fruity aromas and the cloves aromas you can find basically in any kind of wheat beer. Is it a dark, is it a bock, is it a light, or whatever. Even in the non-alcoholic, you will find those aspects. Is there something like that also in the category of bottom fermented beers? So is there also this kind of red line through all those different kind of bottom fermented beer styles you will can define?
So for me, it would be, I think it's more complex, let's say. For the bottom fermented beers, there's not these two aroma substances that basically make up the aroma or most of the aroma, but it's more like the cleanliness of the aroma and the, let's say the perfection of the aroma. Generally, the bottom fermenting yeast delivers less aroma compounds, so like in total about the half, like in milligrams per liter. Generally, the a number of different aroma compounds is quite similar, let's say. And yeah, I think the beer style influence or has the greatest influence on the aroma.
So like when you want to compare it again to the wheat beers, we have these two defining compounds. And the brewers are kind of constructing their wheat beer around those compounds because the wheat beer yeast will make those flavor compounds no matter what. Mm-hmm. Depends on the intensity and how much, but they will produce it. And we are lacking of such defining compounds in the lager beers. So is that maybe like raw materials like the malt or the hops are having a bigger influence on the aroma than maybe the yeast for itself because it's so straight and clean?
Yeah, that's what I would completely agree with. So if you look at the Pilsner, for example, you have the higher bitterness and the hop floral aroma or the citric aroma. There, of course, the hops has a really substantial influence on the aroma. If you look to other beer styles like a Märzen or a dark lager, there, of course, the malt has a bigger influence. But I think the biggest variety can be found in the lager beer, like the as we say in Germany, the Helles style. Mm-hmm. Because there, I think you can also distinguish several categories of a Helles. So you can either have the more malty, cereal-like variety. You can have one that are quite hoppy, but you also find more fruity ones. You find sulfuric ones. So basically, you have a big variety on aroma impressions and aroma and taste impressions, of course.
So basically, the styles in the bottom fermented section are much more independent than like maybe in the wheat beer section that they don't have that kind of in common. Maybe they have in common that they don't have anything in common because the yeast is making this clean and straight beer flavor and clean and straight production of the alcohol and kind of same CO2 level, but that's actually a process thing, but that they have in common that they have basically a not very flavor intense aromatic base, and so the other raw materials can play out their full spectrum.
If they are used in the right way, of course they can.
So bottom line, the thing that they have in common is like the straight and clean fermentation the beer has without any big influence.
I mean, it sets the stage for the flavor there, mm-hmm. which there should be. So, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So we see that it's not that easy to classify like it is in top fermented beers. It's
In the wheat beers.
Yeah, there's a wider range of flavors and of components that are responsible for these flavors.
It seems great and easy, but actually it's much more complicated.
Yeah. Absolutely. So we do have two different types of producing these beers, infusion and decoction.
Yeah, we can have this basically at any beer style, but...
Exactly. Yeah, how much does that influence the taste of the bottom fermented beers?
So the actual difference between infusion and decoction, I think it's not that that substantial, but I think it should match to the flavor and the target flavor of the product you want to produce, of course. So in general, the decoction beers are always said to be a bit more robust, more throaty, and the infusion ones are more lean, more clean, let's say. So basically, I think in your product range, you see it quite well because you use the decoction for the original Helles, which is more malty and has more character, let's say. And the more leaner new helles, it's a bit more fruity and a bit more slim. Therefore, the mashing procedure, of course, fits well.
So it's not actually about taste per se. It's about probably, can you say it's about drinkability?
So I think the one of the key features about the lager beer is, of course, the drinkability.
Drinkability, yeah.
That's what makes it
so successful. Yeah. I think also that the when it comes to infusion, the decoction, to go there one step back, also when it comes to lager beers, it has an influence, I guess, the more characterful you want to make a beer, like a dark Doppelbock, I guess you can't make them with infusion because you want to have like this intense roasted and intense body and this massive plate. Mm-hmm. And I guess without doing it twice or triple decoction, I guess you would not achieve that round, but also massive flavor and mouthfeel, then I would not guess that infusion would fit there. So I think that the expectation of the style has also a lot to do with that. But on the other hand, I think it's so interesting to have like a dark Doppelbock and or a straight, clean, super drinkable, easygoing Helles, like with the same yeast, yeah, and still working on the same fermentation base. Yeah. This is very fascinating, actually. But still two super different beers, which has actually, when it comes to the taste, I would say nothing in common.
Yeah.
When it comes to wheat beer, you know, like the non-alcoholic Hefeweiss beer has like a slight banana flavor, a slight cloves aroma. When it going like to the, I don't know, Vitus wheat beer bock, then you have the same flavors, so that they have at least in common, even it's different intensity. But when it comes to Helles and a dark Doppelbock, I guess there's nothing in common.
So let me give you a little statement, and you tell me if it's true or not, and why. And this is something to provoke all the lager beer fans a little bit. So we've talked a lot about the aromas now, and compared to the wheat beer, which has some stronger aromas. And so let me just put it this way. If I want more taste, I have to drink a wheat beer. Would you say that's true? Or if not, why?
Well, it depends on on which wheat beer and which lager beer, of course. But in general, yes. So the top fermented beers, they have more aroma, since the top fermenting yeast basically produces more. And also in combination with the higher fermentation temperatures, of course. But, I mean, there are, of course, bottom fermented beers, they are stuffed with flavor.
Sure. Yeah. And but in general, we can say it's true. So that leads me to another question, because I anticipated you saying that. So that leads me to the question, is a top fermented beer more forgiving than a bottom fermented beer when it comes to off flavors? So because, you know,
brewing mistakes.
Exactly. Because, you know, when we learned that there's a lot more flavor in it, does it cover off flavors better than bottom fermented beers?
Absolutely. So you have to think about your beer as a mixture of a lot of aroma compounds, and these aroma compounds, they interact with one another within the beer, but also at your at your nose, where you perceive the aromas and you further process it to the sensory sensation, which is a wheat beer, for example. And of course, since you have more positive flavors that are quite stable in your beer, the challenge or the concurrence is higher for the off flavor to be really pronounced there.
So, speaking of these off flavors, we know that bottom fermented beers are not that forgiving for that. What are these off flavors that can, you know, appear in bottom fermented beers? Can you tell us
what are the
most common ones?
The most common ones.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So if I had to name a few, it would be diacetyl, which is a buttery aroma, and then DMS, dimethyl sulfide, which is vegetable, corn, canned corn-like, and acetaldehyde, which is green apple, which is a, let's say, a young beer aroma. And a very big part is, of course, oxidation, which can have a series of or quite a variety of really impressions, but these would be the most common.
So if we go forward and elaborate a little bit on that, how does that diacetyl come into the beer? How does that work?
So the diacetyl is in every beer, and it has to be below a certain sensory threshold, let's say. Below that threshold, it's actually it gives the beer a bit more creaminess, a bit more palatefulness, and just supports the base aroma, let's say. But it's produced within the yeast metabolism, since a yeast degrades amino acids. Basically end up with alpha acetolactate, which is an intermediate compound. Yeast splits it and ends up with the diacetyl, which is first within the cell, then with outside of the cell, and at the later stage the diacetyl is reduced again by the yeast, and this reduction of keto group to a hydroxy group makes it just interrupt me when I'm too
don't worry yeah.
That basically makes it so this reduction basically makes it more soluble in the water, we say hydrophilic, and therefore the sensory threshold is higher, and the sensory impression is
so it's very strongly connected to the fermentation and yeast performance.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the yeast viability would be...
So the healthiness actually of the yeast is a big issue here. You have some technological aspects and parameters you can act on to reduce it or to get it under control.
Exactly.
So if we spin it the other way around, if you don't give the beer enough time to mature, this is something that turns up, right? So let's say it's summer and a brewery needs to get out beer because there's such a high demand for beer. And they just, they reduce the time of maturing by a lot. That's probably a common off flavor, right?
It's And
also the green apple flavor, it's also some kind of, when you're rushing your production, like giving the beer not the time it needs, then...
Yeah, exactly. So in that case, it wouldn't be only this buttery aroma, but it would be the young beer flavor, how we call it. Mm-hmm. And in combination with green apple and diacetyl, and you would have this, let's say, a bit non-harmonic aroma there.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So the off flavors in a lager beer, especially in a pale lager beer, can be recognized much easier than in other kind of beers, or even in a darker lager. I guess the malt flavor compounds also masking some of those off flavors. So pale lagers like a Helles or a Pilsner are some kind of the crown discipline, like the highest discipline for a brewer to show his skills, like, because it's the hardest to brew, because any mistake you would make could be immediately recognizable?
Yeah, absolutely. That would be the hardest beer styles for me would be a really clean lager and a clean pilsner.
So how would you define then, or how would you do, I don't know, under which criteria you would say as a pale, maybe let's say a Helles, a Bavarian style Helles, how would you rate a beer like that? So if you have it and you taste it, so what are the criteria where say, okay, that's now a good Helles on your sensorial approach to it.
We already discovered in season one, I think it's always a question of why are you doing this and what do you want out of it. But what is a good Helles would be a clean aroma. So within this aroma, categories I mentioned can be fruity, malty, sulfuric, and of course the absence of off flavors, then would be quite a taste wise, let's say. So the basic taste would be quite low each, maybe a bit sweet, sourness of course, but not too bitter. And I think salty and umami shouldn't be there. And then the taste or the mouthfeel itself would be lean, clean, and smooth, but also not too watery, since that can or is, let's say, not accepted for a Bavarian style Helles.
So a little bit bread grain flavor is acceptable, but the plate should be very straight and not too thick.
Yeah, but also not too watery.
Not too watery. So it's a thin line to walk on.
Exactly, but that's also, that would be a distinction between the American style lager to the Bavarian style lager, let's say.
Mm. So we got a little off topic here because we still have another off flavor to discuss.
Yeah.
The what was it? DMS. I think was it. Yeah. So can you tell us a little more about that? Because we talked about the diacetyl. How does DMS develop, or how does it get into the beer?
Yeah, so DMS is a compound that smells like canned maize, let's say, or canned corn. And usually if you open a can of corn, it's the first impression you get. So that would be also a way for the listeners to really perceive this isolated aroma. And basically, in your grain, when you steep it during germination, you have enzymatic reaction that comes up, and it produces from the amino acid methionine, it produces S-methylmethionine, and this compound is, let's say, not stable at higher temperatures, and DMS can be cleaved off. So if you go through the process already during your drying of your malt, you want the DMS basically to be gone and to get out. And then during the wort production, when you boil the wort, you basically want most of the DMS to evaporate. And then you have to be careful, because if you still have the precursor left, and your temperatures, for example, at the whirlpool are too high, you can have this thermal cleavage again, so that you really have the aroma compound in your beer, and but the temperature is not high enough to fully evaporate it, and then you end up with
So it's an indicator for not that good brew house performance. Exactly. In the end.
Okay. So we talked a lot about the off flavors now.
One thing is also very interesting, because it's one of your core aspects in your work, is the aging.
Exactly.
Of lager beers, top fermented, bottom fermented lager beers. It's the topic of your PhD thesis. And so we know there are a few, light struck flavor, oxidation, aging, whatever. So there are a few components. Just name them very quickly, and they're the most common. But also what is more interesting, I guess, is how to prevent them when you have your beer at home. So what can you do as a customer, as a listener to this, when you're having your beer at home, how to prevent them to age too quickly or whatever?
So basically the aroma of a beer changes continuously, so constantly, and depends on how you store the beer, of course, to say this at first, let's say, use a dark fridge or a dark chamber for your beer to avoid the sun to come in. Also, first of all, for the light, but also if the light hits the beer, it also warms up. That would be the second one. Store it in cold, and that's basically the only thing you can do. And if people ask this question, I think the best you can do for a beer is to drink it immediately and as fast as you can.
Well, don't need to tell me that.
But then what you might end up in a beer or in a typical beer aging, you might end up with the reduction of a sulfuric aroma. Maybe if you have fruity aroma, they will also degrade over time. And in contrast to that, you will end up with a cardboard flavor sometimes in the first stage maybe of aging. Then second stage, you end up with bready notes, you grainy notes, you get caramel aromas. And at the extreme stage, you can also get sherry and in that context, let's say.
So actually, there is this saying that some kind of beer styles are profiting from aging, like dark, alcohol-intense beers. When they're getting a sherry aroma, it's very positively percepted. Or also when some kind of beer style is getting this more like caramelic aroma through aging, then it's also more like a positive perception, right?
Exactly, yeah. So and I think it's a rule of thumb that dark beers, they
age better.
Aroma, of course, they age better, and the aroma, they are more, like more complement more what's already there, let's say. Mm-hmm. But in a lager, in a Bavarian style lager or some American style lager, they the aging is always anhedonic.
Okay.
So it should be avoided.
So what is it that, I mean, everything we've heard now, we've heard a lot of positive aspects, we heard a lot of negative aspects. What is it that these bottom fermented beers are so popular all over the world? I think you read about some statistic.
I don't know if the numbers are correct. Just read it once on the internet, and we know about information on the internet. How can they be true or not? So the internet is the internet. But I've read there that 90%, 95% of the worldwide beer volume, so the hectoliters are brewed worldwide every year, 95% of them are bottom fermented lager beers. So I don't know if this is a very correct number, but I can imagine that like this kind of number could be correct, because when you see like at the big global brands, like the big volume brands, they're all pale bottom fermented lagers. And so I would say that it's the most successful beer in the world when it comes to the volume, because a lot of volume means a lot of people like to drink it. Mm-hmm. So why do you think is it that popular to beer drinkers?
I think the most important point is the drinkability. Mm-hmm. So I guess most people consume it because it's a refreshing drink, therefore also at low temperatures. And I think the drinkability speaks for it. That would be a key difference to the wheat beers. I think they are just too thick and too aromatic to consume it over and over, let's say, in a mm-hmm. session. And another part is also what we discussed with aroma of flavors and everything. I think the Helles is really straightforward, honest, and that's what makes it so popular.
Honest beer for honest people.
It's not much, but it's honest work.
Yeah, it's not much, but it's an honest beer.
Last question. You have to tell us about two favorites of yours. One, what is your favorite bottom fermented style? And two, what's your favorite food to pair with your favorite style?
I'm always quite drawn between a kettle beer, which is more on the malty caramel side, let's say, and pilsner on the other hand, if it's a quite hop aromatic pilsner. I think I would go with the kettle beer and pork belly.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah. Oh yeah, Keller beer and some pork belly. Oh yeah, that's really good. Yeah. And maybe some cabbage salad to it. Mm. Oh yeah, yeah.
I'll go with that.
Good thing is, after we ended this record of the podcast, we actually go to the brewery restaurant, and I guess that's a good piece to order when we now go down there.
Definitely, definitely. And Thank you so much, Florian. Third time here.
Thank you again.
Third time.
Thanks for having me again.
And altogether, thanks for your expertise. Because I guess this is one of the most relatable topics for our listeners, and also see a little bit behind what makes the taste, what defines the taste, and maybe what's behind that. And I guess at the end, making beer can be very interesting, but at sometimes maybe for the consumers or the fans of the beer and the brand, it's sometimes a little bit super nerdy when there are like some brewers here talking about how to decoction, mash, whatever. It's a little bit too Sheldon Cooper-ish then at that point. But I guess it's very relatable for the people to hear something about how to taste, and maybe also some of the chemical stuff behind. It's also a little bit nerdy, but I guess so people can have a better relation to what they are tasting, or maybe now find out that they are tasting this. And
it's important to understand the big picture of it, that there's much more behind it than throw some malt, hops, and water in a tank and let it sit there for a couple of weeks. It's way more than that. There's happening a lot behind the scenes. And thanks for explaining it to us. And, probably more to me than to Matthias, because he studied it. But thank you for listening, all of you listeners out there. Thank you, Florian, again. And we'll meet with you in the next episode.
See you next time, I guess.
All right.
Yeah, we hope so. I guess we'll find enough topics about sensor analysis of beer to do a fourth episode.
Perfect.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Bye-bye, everyone. Yeah.